So, ladies and gentlemen, Professor Noam Chomsky.
Thanks.
After the introduction, I think maybe I ought to give a campaign talk for Jill Stein. I'm disciplined, so I'll talk about what I was asked to talk about, which is Iraq and the connection between Iraq and the so-called war on terror. There is a connection. It's pretty thin, but it's been drawn. Intelligence agencies have pointed out that they can't detect any real connection between Iraq and the terrorist networks, Al-Qaeda and the rest, which isn't too surprising. But there is a connection, nevertheless, and it's been pointed out. Namely, we can create a link if we want. And the best way to create the link would be by attacking Iraq. It's expected widely that if we do attack Iraq, that's very likely to ignite terrorist attacks, maybe that are already being planned as a possible deterrent. And it's very likely to spawn a new generation of terrorists who will be seeking revenge and also deterrence. And the deterrence is not a slight matter. Those of you who've been following the international relations literature, I'm going to be very establishment in this talk. I'm only going to quote people right in the mainstream. People who've been following it know that leading scholars, respected figures in international relations, have been pointing out for some time, in fact, well before Bush, that U.S. adventurism is stimulating a proliferation of weapons of mass destruction as a deterrent. That's not just countries that are being specifically targeted for attack, but others who are concerned about deterring a state that seeks, I'm quoting now, unilateral world domination through absolute military superiority and is becoming a menace to itself and the world under a radical nationalist leadership. I've been quoting Kenneth Waltz, a well-known figure in international relations, and Anatole Yevhen, who's the senior associate of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. In fact, even real hardliners are expressing pretty serious concerns. So one of the leading military and strategic analysts who's concerned primarily with the Middle East, Anthony Cordesman, who's about as hard line as you can get within anything that might be called the spectrum of sanity. He warned recently against what he called the neoconservative fantasies of the sillier armchair strategists and their plans for reconstructing the Middle East and maybe the world. He was referring to Richard Perle and Douglas Feith, but that also includes Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, others who all happen to be very close to the extreme right wing in Israel. So you're getting quite a lot of clear and good reporting from the mainstream Israeli press about them. As maybe you know, Richard Perle, who's very close to the center of planning now, and Douglas Feith were writing position papers for Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's new foreign minister, who's well to the right of Ariel Sharon, you know. So they were doing that in the 1990s, and that's their connections and contacts. And it's not understandable that even a hardline military analyst like Cordesman is worried about their sillier proposals, which are in fact being thought about and maybe implemented. That's about the only connection I know of between Iraq and terrorism at the moment. We can stimulate terrorism if we really intend to. So why Iraq? I mean, obviously not in order to stimulate terrorism. Well, before going into that, begin with a kind of a truism, which should be unnecessary to mention. In the case of either the threat of or a resort to violence, the burden of proof is always on those who advocate it. So that's true whether it's domestic abuse or international affairs. And it's a heavy burden. Maybe there's an argument for it, but it's the it's those who advocate force and violence who have to bear the burden, and it's a heavy one. You never need any arguments against the use of violence. That's automatic. You need an argument for it. It has to be a very strong one. That should be obvious, and I'll just put it in back. So why do they want to do it? Well, to simplify, since time's brief, I'll pick two views that are expressed pretty prominently in the mainstream, and I'll quote mainstream analysts. So here's the first interpretation. I'll start with Yusuf Ibrahim in the International Herald Tribune a couple of days ago. He's a senior fellow of the Council on Foreign Relations and was a senior Middle East correspondent for the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal for about 30 years, until very recently moved to the CFR recently. His interpretation is that the goals of the Bush administration are basically two. One, gaining short-term political advantage, and two, I'm quoting him now, turning Iraq into a private American oil pumping station. Well, there's a counter-argument to that, against that in the New York Times yesterday. Maybe a response to it, I don't know, by Serge Schmemann, who argues that kind of disparages the oil relationship on the grounds that there's not going to be an instant bonanza for Iraqi oil. And it's true, but it's not a very persuasive argument. I mean, by the same argument, you can prove that nobody was interested in Iraqi oil 80 years ago, or Texas oil, or Saudi Arabian oil, or Venezuelan oil, or certainly not Alaskan or North Sea oil. I mean, really expensive to get it. So by that argument, yeah, it's true, you're not going to get billions of dollars tomorrow, and it'll take development funds. But the argument is very weak. In fact, much weaker in the case of Iraqi oil, which is vast and relatively easily accessible, than it was in numerous other cases. So I think we can dismiss the counter-argument. Which was, I think, a front-page story in the Times Week in Review yesterday. Well, that's Yusuf Ibrahim. Yevon, who I quoted before, has a more detailed analysis along the same lines. He suggests that the Bush administration, the political aspect, is following, I'm quoting him, the classic modern strategy of an endangered right-wing oligarchy, which is to divert mass discontent into nationalism, inspired by fear of enemies about to destroy us. And he speaks for many people in the world when he regards that as the U.S. government's policies now as a menace to itself, meaning the country, and to the world. Well, September 11th provided a pretext for resort to force, not just for the United States. That's worldwide, and it was predicted at once. So the Russians in Chechnya, the Chinese against their Western minorities, Indonesia and Aceh, Israel in the occupied territories, I mean, all over the world, repressive governments that were engaged in violent repression used September 11th as a pretext to intensify it under the guise of a war on terror, and assuming correctly that they'd get a nod of approval from the boss in Washington. And it's not too surprising that the U.S. itself would adopt the same idea. So yes, 9/11 was a pretext, and it was also used as a pretext to discipline populations throughout the world, again, under the guise of a war on terror. And that ranges from the Central Asian dictatorships all the way over to the more democratic countries, including our own. So the fact that September 11th would prove a pretext for a war in Iraq is not a great surprise. And in fact, this was pointed out also to pursue the domestic political agenda, as Lievin points out, natural for an endangered right-wing oligarchy to do that, especially when it's carrying out quite an extensive attack against the domestic population. It's not a big secret, or it shouldn't be. In the U.S., that was pointed out right away by Paul Krugman and one of his well-known economists and one of his regular New York Times columns, who reported right away that literally before the dust had settled over the World Trade Center ruins, influential Republicans signaled that they were determined to use terrorism as an excuse to pursue a radical right-wing agenda. And he and others have been documenting how they've been following that course ever since. Again, shouldn't be a secret, so I won't pursue it. The Beast of Baghdad was then brought in to be an even more terrifying threat. And there are also independent reasons. There is a long-standing goal, Ibrahim and others are surely correct, and it's kind of obvious. It's been a long-standing goal to restore to U.S. control the second largest oil reserves in the world. It's been recognized ever since the mid-40s, quote the State Department in 1945, that this is a major component of what they called a stupendous source of strategic power and one of the greatest material prizes in world history, and a major theme of U.S. foreign policy since the Second World War has been to make sure that the U.S. Dominates it. France was expelled on the interesting grounds that it was an enemy state since it had been occupied by Germany, so therefore its contracts were void, and England was slowly reduced to what the British Foreign Office calls a junior partner. The U.S. puts it differently. 40 years ago, a senior statesman, probably Dean Acheson, in internal discussion described Britain as our lieutenant. The fashionable word is partner, and they like to hear the fashionable word, but the reality is the actual word. And control over Middle East oil has been a very large part of it from the Second World War. Let me stress that it's control, it's not access. There's a lot of confusion about that. The United States really doesn't care much about access to Middle East oil. Up until 1970, it didn't care at all. North America was the biggest producer, but that didn't affect the need to control the region. Since then, the biggest importer has usually been Venezuela. If you look at U.S. intelligence projections, for example, the National Intelligence Council projections for the next 15 years, they predict and suggest that the U.S. should rely on a more secure Atlantic Basin resources, West Africa and Latin America. But that has absolutely nothing to do with control over Middle East oil. Now, that has to do with its being one of the greatest material prizes in world history, which means that whoever controls it and can have an effect on setting price and production levels, can also determine that the wealth, vast amount of the wealth, flows right back here, and it does. It's independent of access to oil. A stupendous source of strategic power has nothing to do with access. That translates as a lever of world control, and that's been recognized clearly since the 1940s, and it remains true today. Well, September 11th gave a pretext. The domestic politics affects the timing, and the strategy has been working quite brilliantly. You see it right now in the midterm elections. It's going to be even more important next year, presumably. If you put yourselves in, say, Karl Rove's shoes, Bush's campaign manager, when the presidential campaign begins in a little over a year, do you really want people to be thinking about what's happening to their pension or how they're going to take care of their elderly mother or, what about their job or, why can't they get health care? What about an environment that their children might live in? Things like that are certainly not what they want people to be paying attention to. They'll want people to be, singing praises to the brave cowboy who saved them from destruction at the hands of a colossal foe, sort of Martian foe, and will by then be marching on to some new adventure. Exactly as Yevon says, that's the tradition. That's the classic strategy of an endangered right-wing oligarchy, which wants to divert mass content, which has plenty of ground, into nationalism and fear. And it takes a lot of work to overlook the fact that the only people who are afraid of Condoleezza Rice's mushroom cloud, which is going to consume us imminently, the only people who are afraid of it are Americans, not the people of the region, for example. I mean, they're afraid, but they're afraid of the United States more than they are of Iraq. Of course, Iraqis are afraid of Saddam Hussein, and they have every right to be, but that can't possibly be the reason for the U.S. war. I mean, the U.S. was supporting Saddam right through his worst atrocities, helping him develop weapons of mass destruction right up to the day of the invasion of Kuwait. And it's the same people who are running Washington right now. So whatever the reasons are, it's not that. They're afraid of Saddam Hussein, but they also know that he can't do very much. In fact, very little. If he made a move anywhere, you know, Iraq would be obliterated. He knows that, and the people in the region know that. Even the U.S. press, the national press, which is usually highly supportive of power, now recognizes that, quoting, the world is more concerned about the unbridled use of American power than it is about the threat posed by Saddam Hussein. It's a lead story in the Christian Science Monitor a couple days ago, and it's been pointed out by others. So there definitely is a security issue. There's a problem of securing the agenda of the radical right-wing oligarchy and making sure that they can continue for another 4 years to undermine living standards, destroy social policy, concentrate the wealth in a very narrow sector of an unusually corrupt part of the business establishment, as Krugman and many others have been pointing out. And to pursue that, to secure that agenda is very serious. And it is a security problem, and that's about the only security problem anyone can seem to conjure up. But it's real, of course. Well, that's one interpretation. One interpretation, well, within the mainstream establishment, is what I just said. There's a long-term goal of regaining control over the second largest resources in the Middle East and ensuring domination of one of the greatest material prizes in world history and a stupendous source of strategic power. September 11th gave a pretext, as it gave a pretext around the world, for intensification of violence and disciplining of populations. And domestic considerations and that very important security problem, they probably account for the timing. So it has to be this winter, not next winter. That'll be too late. By then we'll have been consumed by the mushroom cloud, which will avoid everyone else but hit us. And of course, it's just kind of like an accident that that'll be the right in the middle of the presidential campaign, just as it's an accident that the people of the region are afraid, but mostly of us, joining much of the world in that. Well, that's one interpretation. All of this is not only the classic strategy of an endangered right-wing oligarchy under a radical nationalist leadership, as Levin points out, but it's also second nature to the people in Washington. Remember that the people running the show are recycled Reaganites, right? Almost entirely. They come out of the Reagan administration when they were doing precisely the same thing. I mean, the first thing, when they came into office, when the Reagan administration came into office in 1981, first thing it did was declare a war on terror with pretty much the same rhetoric as today. At that time, Americans had to be terrified by Libyan hitmen who were wandering the streets of Washington planning to kill our leader, another brave cowboy, who was hiding in the White House surrounded by tanks. I mean, if you're old enough, you'll remember that, or your parents will. That was 20 years ago. And they had to be worried about the Sandinistas, who were only 2 days marching time from Texas, the brave cowboy told us. And they were following a script, the script of Mein Kampf, in their plan to conquer the hemisphere, if not beyond. That was George Shultz, the administration moderate, the Colin Powell of the day. And there was a national emergency called, renewed every year because of the threat to the U.S. Security and survival posed by people like that, for example, by Gaddafi, who was planning to expel America from the world, according to Reagan, or at least his speechwriters. And people were afraid. I mean, this is traditionally a very frightened society. You can ask about the reasons, but it's well known. Americans happen to be more frightened of almost anything than most other people. All kind of historical reasons, but it's clearly true. That can be crime, aliens, drugs, you name it. There's a lot of fear, it's not hard to stir up fear among the population, and it was going on right through the 80s. So all of this is absolutely second nature to the guys making policy today, and it wouldn't be too surprising if that's what they're planning. Well, my time's just about running out, which is fine, because there is another view, which I can fortunately skip since there's no time, and that's what you hear every time George Bush or Tony Blair or someone who supports them reads from their note cards or maybe makes it up themselves. We can, and you're familiar with that, so I don't have to repeat it. I'll just end with this. We could run through the arguments. I don't know if it's necessary, but more interesting in a way is just to accept all the claims as true. So let's say everything they say is true, okay? If you can, then you can run a little experiment. It's pretty easy to show that if the claims are true, there are very simple ways to meet the announced goals. I'm not just talking about sending back inspectors. There are other ways if you decide that a war is necessary. Measures that really haven't been considered. Kind of instructive to ask why, but I'll stop there since time's running out.
Well, we have